It's the All Things Strange Podcast. We are your hosts, Agent Anderson and
Agent Ether.
Come along as we examine UFO sightings, conspiracies, and all things strange. You can check out all of our wonderful links in the description on the Linktree, where you can find our Discord, our merchandise, our Facebook, and more. Our Patreon?
That's Patreon. On there too. Gotta join the Patreon.
Yeah. This week's episode, from the files of Project Blue Book, Part 8.
So excited. I actually suggested this a couple weeks ago. I was like, why don't we do another Blue Book case? One of my favorite topics.
This is one of my favorite ones as well. I love the Blue Book stuff. As voted upon by our Patreon subscribers, we've got three wonderful tiers. The first tier will get you early access to new videos and after hours. The second tier will get you bonus episodes. And the third tier will allow you to vote on upcoming topics such as this one.
Yeah, I love the Blue Book files, and you can find all kinds of declassified information. And a lot of times, very few people have looked through them, and you can tell on fold 3, it gives you a count of how many people have actually viewed the page you are looking at, and the world's so big, but this, I don't know, this part of the world is so small.
Yeah, there's some files you see that have only been viewed like 10 times.
Exactly.
And the reason that's so surprising to me is that there's a pretty significant interest in this topic, and yet so few people are interested in looking up these old files and these old documents, which is unfortunate because they are so good. There's so many great cases in here that are just kind of forgotten to history.
Yeah, and not only cases, but other little tidbits that you'll find.
That's right. There's all kinds of crazy stuff in there.
Mm-hmm, not just case files.
You never know what you're going to find. All right, well, we'll switch off. Why don't I start off with my first one? I decided to look at 1967.
No way!
Yes way.
Mine is also from 1967.
Uh-oh, I hope we didn't do the same thing.
I don't think we did, but oftentimes when we're looking at Blue Book files, we do not collaborate. We just look for our own thing. But it'd be really funny if we picked the same cases because those odds are pretty small.
There's something like 13,000 reports in total, so the chances of us picking the same one, not that good. But so I chose 1967 because normally on these Blue Book case files, I tend to choose earlier years. So I figured, what the heck, I'll choose one of the later years. The project ended in 1969, so I figured let's go towards the end of that. 1966, we've talked about many times before. The first episode, the swamp gas, happened during 1966. That year has the highest number of entries, but 1967 was second, even beating out years like 1952 that were major well-known UFO flaps. So it appears, I mean, if you look at the numbers, it looks like there was not just a flap in 1966, but it looks like there was a multi-year flap going on. For example, here's the number of entries for each year starting in 1962. This is the number of pages. They don't say the number of case files on Fold 3, but they say, you know, how many thousands of pages they have for that year. So 1962 and 63 both have about 3,000 pages. 64 jumps up, almost doubling to 5,000. 1965 almost doubles again to 9,000. 66 is the highest number of records for any year at 12,000. And then 1967 dips down a bit to 10,000, which is still, like I said, higher than any other year than 1966. And then 1968 drops down to 7,000. In 1969, all the way down to 2000. But I think the reason why 69 is so low is because that at that point they were winding it down. They were winding down Project Blue Book, and they probably weren't taking as many reports as they had been in the past. And they were trying to downplay the whole thing and tell people, you know, it's not a big deal. Don't bother calling in. you know, we don't want to hear about it anymore. We've been doing this for a while now, and it's all just a bunch of nonsense.
So they closed the public face.
Right, but like I've talked about before on this show, there was also a second reporting method for UFOs. They talk about that in a document that's been released when they closed Blue Book, and they said that files that were of national security concern would continue to be reported through the standard channels designed for that purpose. They didn't say what it was. They didn't say what the name of the project or program was. They just said that there was a whole other thing for handling UFOs. Pretty interesting stuff. And like I said, you know, if you're willing to dig through these documents, you'll find some proof. I mean, they're talking about, people speculate all the time, like, oh, I wonder if they're covering stuff up or whatever. If you look through the documents, you will find that, yes, they are definitely covering stuff up.
For sure, for sure.
Without a doubt. What the stuff is, I don't know, but it's stuff that had national security concerns. That's more or less all we know about it.
And it remains classified because we don't know. So no FOIA for you.
Probably classified to this day, for sure, yeah. So yeah, anyways, the 60s, it looks like pretty much starting in 1964 on through 1968, that's like a four-year flap, possibly longer, although Blue Book would not have the numbers probably for 1969 and obviously not after that. So we have a multi-year flap here, which is pretty cool. So we haven't talked about stuff from 1967 all that much that I can remember, and that's pretty much why I decided on 1967. There are plenty of good cases from 67 as there are any other year. So what the heck? Why not? All right, first up, this one happened on January 30th in California, Missouri.
California, Missouri?
There is a California, Missouri.
That's silly. Does it have a beach at least?
Nope. Not that I know. It's landlocked.
No surfers?
Nope. Maybe it has, you know,
like a lake with a sandy shore.
Maybe it has a sea of waving grain or something. I don't know.
Maybe they got a bunch of hot girls in their California tens, so they call it California.
Maybe. It's a small town in Missouri, though, so.
Okay.
Somehow I doubt it. I actually looked it up because I thought, is this a misprint? Do they mean that this was sighted in California and Missouri? Because sometimes it's something is sighted in two different places. But there is actually a California, Missouri. It's a small town. And that's all I know about it. I didn't look up any of the local cultures or anything like that. This sighting had two witnesses, and it happened at 0700 Zulu, which I'm not sure what that is local time. That's like the military's version of UTC. Why Zulu? I don't know.
Because it sounds cool.
Yeah, it does sound pretty cool. I thought that was like a tribe in Africa or something. The witnesses reported a P-shaped light. That was, I don't know why they didn't say just a circle, a round light. I don't know, but they said P-shaped. Maybe they meant that it had some texture on it too or something. I don't know. But a P-shaped light that was bright, and it was blue, red, green, and white in color. And it moved in a rough forward and backward motion, and it disappeared to the north. The sighting lasted between 4 and 8 minutes, and the witnesses described the movement as very erratic. Immediately after the object left, the witnesses saw a plane fly overhead. The Air Force, it says on the cover card of the case, the Air Force says that they could find no record of this plane, because when a plane flies, they have to file, you know, a flight plan with wherever they're leaving from, and then they have to stick to that flight plan. It's a safety thing. And also, radar towers will have records of the plane, and, you know, there's just, whenever somebody's flying around, there's generally a good record of who they are, what kind of plane they're flying, where they're going, and where they're coming from. That's just pretty standard when it comes to aviation. But the Air Force could find no record of this airplane.
Or so they said.
Well, you'll see. I mean, okay. I think they're serious about that. So here's a quote from the document. Preparing officer, Second Lieutenant St. Martin Jr., Assistant Ground Training Officer, BOT, Extension 3108, Box 639, Whiteman Air Force Base, Missouri, 65301. So there's the address for you if you guys like to try to contact Officer Martin Jr.
And descendants.
Assuming he's not retired yet. He could still be at active duty, you know. This was only 1967. continuing on. Personal interviews with the observers of the sightings, and I have found them very, that's a typo, and I have found them very reliable and positive in relating their information. However, after considerable discussion with our weather officer, Second Lieutenant Wade, I believe the lights were caused by weather conditions at that time consisted of a front moving across the area, causing radical vertical temperature changes.
Wow.
The source of the lights could have been a plane sighted in the area soon after the lights were seen. So let's think about the logic here, what this guy's trying to propose.
First of all, is this guy a scientist?
No,
what I'm saying. He's not a scientist. So that seems like interesting conclusion to draw just based on your own speculation without even consulting like an expert or at least somebody with some knowledge.
Yeah. Well, keep in mind at this point in time, Blue Book was in full cover-up mode. This was towards the end when there was no semblance whatsoever. Quit shaking my camera, Toby. Jeez. When there was no semblance whatsoever of investigation. They were doing anything and everything they could to explain away these sightings and these cases.
I see.
So that's kind of some of the background, and that's why the guy who wrote this report, Second Lieutenant St. Martin Jr., was bending over backwards to explain this one away. And he did that. He said, okay, so first of all, the lights were caused by weather conditions. Also, the lights were caused by the plane that the witnesses saw after they saw the lights.
Well, that makes sense.
It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. It's just completely ridiculous. They're just bending over backwards here to try to say anything to try to explain this stuff away. It's pretty incredible. This is one of the worst explanations I've ever seen in the Blue Book files, and there's a lot of bad ones. This one kind of takes the cake. Anyways, that little part ends with "for the commander." Very official sounding there. How can the UFO and the plane be the same thing? That's what he's saying, basically, right? So that the UFO was seen, but the plane seen after the UFO was actually the UFO, even though the plane was separate from the UFO. It's weird. I don't know. It's completely strange mental gymnastics. Okay, so let's move on here. This is another quote from the documents. Quote, two local reliable businessmen reported an unidentified flying object at 0100 this morning on 30th of January. It approached from the east from Russellville and went over the redacted farm, at which point it turned northwest and flew directly over California. The object had lights that were white, green, red, and reddish blue, very bright, similar to Xmas tree lights. They were cycling very fast, no sound involved, estimated half a mile high. Half a mile high is like 2,000, 3,000 feet, so that's not super high as far as aviation goes anyways. The object was going up and down at varying rates of speed. Cannot estimate size or shape, but observers stated the motion was too slow for a plane and too fast for a helicopter.
Very interesting.
That sounds like a plane to me. That's how planes act, right? Then the next page, it's just like a blank page with some handwritten math on there.
Huh.
I don't know what to make of this, but so handwritten, it's 833.13 plus 853.08 equals 1686.21.
Well, I have a thought about that. I think somebody just needed some scratch paper and there it was.
Yeah, but why did they keep it in the file?
It was an accident.
It's just a blank page. Or maybe, maybe it has something to do with the case. I don't know. It's very mysterious, though. And the other math problem is 29.7 plus 116.82 equals 146.79.
Somebody's budgeting.
Minus 133 equals 33.79. Those are correct, by the way. I checked with a calculator because, you know, I don't like arithmetic and it doesn't like me. What does it mean? It's just, I don't know. It's mysterious. It's kind of fun though, right? And then there's another number, this old, more numbers upside down. You can't see all of them, but there's one line you can see that looks like 5,000 minus 46 degrees. And there's three lines of this. You can't really read them though. And then the next page has more numbers written that looks kind of like weather data. You have like degrees and temperatures and things. And then you have upside down on that page. Again, you have 0100 or I should say 0100 30 IAN 060030 IAN. I don't know what IAN means, but this report was at 0100 hours on the 30th. So maybe that's just a time code. I don't know. But a lot of it is pretty faded and difficult to read on those pages. But it looks like, you know, weather, angular sizes or whatever. I don't know, stuff like that.
So somebody's looking at it and taking it seriously.
Yes.
If they're writing down all this data, thinking about calculations, even mm-hmm. if they're just jotting down some notes, they're looking at this file.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Both witnesses filled out that handy-dandy questionnaire. You know the one I'm talking about.
Yep.
The one that's really good. I won't go over those in, you know, too much detail because it's, I don't know, we don't need to know what temperature it was and all that stuff. I don't think that's really pertinent. But there was no wind, which doesn't necessarily mean anything because if there's no wind on the ground, there can still be wind up in the air. So who knows? And we have some newspaper articles to go along with this story.
So a couple witnesses.
Yeah. So the first article says, I'm summarizing that one. There were two groups of witnesses that saw the UFO. One was in California and the other one was in Fayette. The article even references famous cases from different time periods, such as the one in 1897, where a cattle was lassoed and taken onto a flying saucer. The very first case of cattle mutilation/abduction. But it turns out, I've talked about this one before on this show, that was actually, can you guess what that one was, Agent Ether?
A cow being lassoed into a UFO?
Yes.
I've never heard of this.
This was actually a liar's club.
Oh, where yeah, you did tell me about
people
that.
People would compete to see who could get the most ridiculous thing published in the newspaper, basically. So our earliest case of cattle mutilation is actually, you know, fabricated. What can you do? I don't know. It is what it is, right? It's an interesting little piece of UFO history though, right?
So it's referenced.
Yeah. So they talk about that. They talk about some other cases and they talk about just that they don't spend a whole lot of time on this case, but they do talk about just UFOs in general. Some of the articles not readable, but there are some interesting quotes in the article, such as, quote, one of its members contends that a UFO may have caused the massive short that resulted in power failure and the blackout in Northeast USA in November 1965. I've heard of this case before. I want to look into it more. I put it on the list because it sounds really interesting, right? Okay, so that article, there's actually four articles, but I think it's just the same two articles repeated, and some of them are more readable than others. Okay, so this one is pretty small and hard to read the way it prints out, but I'll do my best.
I have reading glasses.
Would you like to read it?
I would like to see it. Okay. I'm going to see it. Nope.
There it is for the camera.
I can't see it. All right. See, I'm excited because I bought reading glasses. Let me see if I can read it. Nope, can't read it.
You need a refund.
Oh, man. Okay. My eyes are terrible.
I'll do my best here.
Okay.
UFO reported over California. Flying saucers, perhaps? Well, Raymond Barber and Robert Crawford, hey, there's their names right there. and Robert Crawford are not sure, but they describe a phenomenon they witnessed at about 1 a.m. Monday as something they had never seen before. The two men were wolf hunting. on the Earl Morris Farm about 12 miles south of California.
Probably to keep their livestock safe.
Yeah, for sure. When they observed lights approaching from the east, the lights followed a sequence of white, green, perhaps a red, and then an extremely bright blue. The lights were described as being similar to those on a Christmas tree, except that they were blinking at a rapid rate. And I'd just like to point out that this sighting bears a lot of resemblance to a lot of other sightings that I've talked about before that happened in the 1966 wave. Pretty similar in some ways. When the lights reached the Clyde Medlin place, they changed course. Oh, that must be the farm.
Yeah.
Why would they redact it and then not redact it? It's so weird. The Clyde Medlin place, they changed course to the northwest and apparently went directly over California. The men said that although the lights changed altitude up and down at varied rates and moved at a rate too slow for a jet, but too fast for a helicopter, the lights were interesting to watch, they said, but they were unable to estimate the size or shape of the vehicle involved. In recent weeks, there have been numerous reports of unidentified flying objects by numerous reliable witnesses in the Midwest. On hearing this report, a reporter called Troop F of the Highway Patrol to learn there had been other reports of the incident. Whitman Air Force Base at Knob Noster then was called. Knob Noster? What is that? Was called. A request was made to the switchboard operator to speak to someone in regard to sighting a UFO. After a slight delay, an Air Force colonel answered and took down the details. The fact that a colonel answered indicated the Air Force has strong interest in such sightings. While the Air Force did not speculate, the most likely explanation is that the object was a jet plane at high altitude. The particular air layers on the very clear night caused the illusion that the object was at low altitude. Well, except for the witnesses said they heard no noise, and jets are extremely loud. Have you ever heard a jet fly overhead, Agent Ether?
Of course I have.
They are extremely loud. Okay, where was I? Jet high altitude. The particular air layers on the very clear night caused the illusion that the object was at low altitude. Airplanes are equipped with white, green, and red navigation lights. More recently, some are being equipped with strobe lights. These lights give off a brilliant bluish-white light that lasts only a few thousandths of a second and is so intense it could create the effect of the other lights going out or blinking.
Wow, I've never seen that personally.
The strobe lights cannot operate continuously but must blink at a rapid rate. This explanation does not cover the entire incident. Could it have been a... ... Yeah, but this is what the skeptics tend to do. They say, well, the object had lights. This pizza has a light shining on it. Therefore, it was a pizza. Like, their logic is not very logical. You know, they come up with these conclusions that only cherry pick the data that they want to display, but they don't take all of what the witness said into consideration. Let's see. So I talked about that. Oh yeah. Okay. So, and that was that case. That's pretty much all we have for that one.
Awesome.
Pretty cool case. I thought it was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And, but that's all we have on it. I mean, I wonder if you looked into local newspapers, you could find some more descriptions of it, you know, cause both the newspaper articles in there say that other people reported it and saw it, but it doesn't give those firsthand accounts. Only they just say that there were other witnesses. So this would be an interesting one to dig into a little deeper sometime.
Yeah, right. If there's more data, it's always interesting.
Yeah, and who knows?
You can find.
This is the kind of exciting stuff where you know, if I had a budget, I could fly out there and go to the local libraries and dig through all the stacks and the old microfiche.
You would too.
I definitely would. Hell yes, I would. Why the heck not? Especially if there's an amusement park nearby with some good roller coasters.
Be set.
Be all set. Yeah. All right. So what do you got for us, Agent Ether?
I have a dog in my lap.
You sure do.
He was whining. I don't know how I'm going to put him down. Hi. No, he's licking me. Come on down. Let's see if I can do this without him getting all up in my bidnet. Get up my notes here. Okay, so like I mentioned, my case is also from 1967. Just so weird. A coincidence. And I've been thinking a lot recently about Russia. A lot of tensions between, you know, different countries.
A lot of tensions out there right now.
Yeah, so just made me think of the Cold War and Russia and the former Soviet Union. And that made me think of once we were doing some Blue Book files and I ran across, I think you'd call it a report, by the Foreign Technology Division titled The Soviet Effort to Find Extraterrestrial Life.
Okay.
So it's a whole report written about what we knew at that time about what the Soviets were trying to do when it came to SETI, essentially.
Oh, okay. That's so cool.
Mm-hmm. It was written on February, well, it was published on February 3rd, 1967. This was actually right before the Soviets would launch Luna 10, which was the first man-made probe to orbit the moon. So this is kind of around the space race sort of time, height of the Cold War, kind of get some perspective going there. So we're very interested in what the Soviets were doing, of course, but I found it fascinating that not only were they interested in weapons and politics and that sort of thing, but they were interested in their sort of scientific aims when it came to searching for extraterrestrial life.
Despite the government claiming repeatedly that they don't care that much about this stuff.
Right.
If you look at the evidence, the government has always been deeply interested in the topic.
So the report, I'm going to call it a report, opens with a historical perspective on when extraterrestrial life was first contemplated specifically in Western society. So it doesn't really look at like Eastern philosophies. And it speculates that, you know, because of the church specifically, such ideas were really frowned upon. They didn't want people to think about life coming from somewhere else because the Earth was essentially the center of the universe. And even when we discovered that it wasn't the center of the universe, Christian ideology says it's still the origin of life.
Right.
So the report also discusses the relationship between science and science fiction. And this will be really important later on. And they talk about the War of the Worlds broadcast, which we've discussed before, and the mass panic that it caused in big cities.
Actually.
Now, I know what you're going to say. You're going to say, actually, that didn't happen. It didn't cause mass panic as discussed in the media.
There were some people who were upset by it, but it was not the mass
panic. It wasn't widespread. However, I found it interesting that it was included in this report that there was mass panic. I found that interesting because I knew you were going to say that. I knew it. So do you want to hold this guy?
I guess.
He's going crazy.
Toby, come here, Toby.
At this time, post-World War II, the radio telescope was being developed. And this led to a lot of scientists asking the question, can we find intelligent life out there? And can we communicate somehow using radio waves with that intelligent life? The writer of this report, who is never identified, blames the conference of 1964, where great minds gathered to talk about extraterrestrial civilizations here in the United States. They said that it caught the attention of the Soviet Union. So whatever the U.S. can do, the Soviet Union had to do bigger and better back and forth. So they were going to go ahead and hold their own conference, which will be discussed as well. But the point is, one of the reasons this report was written is because the Soviets, in response to our conference, held their own conference and started to publish material, scientific material, about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
Okay.
So I love this quote. "It is impossible to prove or disprove planets the size of Earth, even around nearest stars, much less if there is life on them." So essentially, scientists are in the same boat as they were 2,000 years ago. So they're saying there's no difference between now and 2,000 years ago. We can't tell if there are planets. And I love it because now we've discovered so many planets. You know, we're looking, we can tell if there's maybe water on them, where they are, how close to other planets they are. I mean, it just blows my mind. Planets and planets and planets, like what, tens of thousands of planets.
Well, they're finding that most stars have some kind of planet or planets around them.
So we went in 67 from saying there's no way we're going to know. And here we are, and we do know. It's amazing to me that we have that kind of technology.
Pretty cool stuff.
The writer then points out that Soviets actually have a different perspective, not coming from a Judeo-Christian background, about life and its origins. Hmm. Culturally, there's just a different perspective than ours. So they call it a materialistic philosophy.
Okay.
That's the wording they used for their kind of cultural perspective. And I quote, "It is a normal and inevitable consequence of the development of matter, and intelligence is a normal consequence of the existence of life." So that is a quote from a scientist in the Soviet Union who's essentially saying it is inevitable that there will be life out there, that life exists outside of our planet, our solar system. Like, the Soviets were way more open to this idea than were U.S. scientists at the time. And especially, I think, the people in general in the U.S. compared to the Soviet Union, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. There's a lot of people in the States who were willing to contemplate such things. Even scientists.
Well, they did have a conference. Don't forget, I did mention the conference, but the report states the Soviets are more open to it.
Right.
Especially among the masses. However, the Soviets did believe that any life that existed outside of Earth would have to be hydrocarbon compounds in nature. So nothing like silicone. They're like, no, it's going to be like Earth. And the alternatives didn't really exist in Soviet literature. And I don't mean sci-fi literature. I mean like scientific journals.
Right.
None of them speculated on anything other than hydrocarbon compounds when it came to life outside. And of course, Mars was a big focus because of its proximity to us and its similarities to Earth. It is the most similar to Earth, even though there's a lot of big differences. And in this report, it discusses how the absence of canals, of Martian canals, points to there never being life on Mars. And I love this because we didn't go to Mars at that time. We didn't explore Mars. We didn't know there'd been water on Mars. So they draw this conclusion based on very little evidence. Mm-hmm. There's no Martian canals. There's probably not life out there. And there never was life on Mars. Very little evidence. And then they go on to criticize. And this is funny because this report is classified. So I'm not sure who it's written for or who it's written by, but here's a quote. "The boundary between the possible and the impossible is fairly indistinct. Some people, sometimes bona fide scientists, simply cannot discern this boundary and mix up solid science, their unconscious desires, and fairy tales into a nightmarish whole." What does this mean?
I don't know.
What is it doing in this report?
That's kind of a strange little excerpt there.
Yeah. And even in the context of the report, as I was reading it, it did not make any sense to me. I'm like, why is this in here? Who is reading this report?
That sounds like somebody had a certain chip on their shoulder, perhaps, about something, and then they were... It sounds personal. It doesn't sound objective.
No, it doesn't. So the whole report is written in several sections, and I've kind of, you know, cherry-picked here and there the most what I found to be interesting and compelling parts. Mm-hmm. So the next section is on establishing contact, and that's section 3. And interestingly enough, the further you get in this document, which is about 50 pages long, the less people have viewed this document. So, because it's pretty thick, it's thick material, and it can read a little dry, but I found the content itself quite fascinating, especially historically.
Yeah.
So by the time you get to section 3, there's like 17 people reading it. And I like to pretend we're all reading it together at the same time. And we're going down this rabbit hole together, me and these other people. The problem is, I'm pretty sure I've looked at these pages at least twice. I'm rereading them with myself, I guess. I don't know where I'm going with that. So, establishing contact. In view of the complete absence of concrete data or extraterrestrial civilizations, the only possible formulation of the problem is this. Assuming that there are extraterrestrial civilizations, what would be the best way of getting in touch with them? The problem's twofold. How can understandable signals be transmitted? And two, how can signals from outer space be detected and interpreted? And of course, we know now from our SETI projects and worldwide collaboration that we're using arrays of radio telescopes to do just that.
Right.
To look for extraterrestrial life. And of course, we have all these arguments, especially back then, scientific arguments. And they actually include mathematical models and formulas in this report that argue against the possibility of ever detecting anything because, you know, you have such a wide angular view of the sky. It took so long for the Earth to even develop radio telescopes. How long is our civilization going to be around? And what is the likelihood that another civilization is going to have the same technology be developing at the same time so that we're looking together,
right?
This civilization and us. And in this report, they said basically it's infinitesimal. It's tiny.
It really is, yeah. Mm-hmm. You'd have to assume that they would have technology comparable to ours, and the chances of, I mean, if you look at the cosmological time scale, the chances of that happening is essentially zero. But that doesn't mean that we might not catch some, you know, like Voyager is still out there, and maybe Voyager will be out there a billion years from now still shooting out radio signals, you know?
Wasn't there a Star Trek episode about this?
No, there was a movie.
A whole movie about it. That's right. I forgot about that. What did they call it? Because some of the letters...
V'ger. Yeah.
God, I love V'ger. That's right. That's a good movie.
Yeah, it was a good movie.
It's a good movie.
What I liked the most about that movie is how, you know, the way they frame things or the way they film it, the camera angles, I don't know, whatever. The way they do it, it just gives you this sense of scale. Like everything feels so vast.
It started off kind of slow for me, but I did enjoy it overall.
Yeah,
I did.
It's a good movie.
Even though we had to take a break because I fell asleep, that's just me. I get tired at night. Agent Anderson was talking about recording at, 9?
Yeah.
And I was like, by 10, I'm going to be done.
Yeah.
I was like, there's no way I'm going to last till 10. I am definitely an early bird.
Right, yeah.
I was up at 7 this morning, and yesterday I woke up at 6. So part of that was because my back hurt because I'm getting old, but
yeah.
What can you do? Anyways, getting back into it, love this topic. Okay, so the report goes on to state, after talking about a lot in detail how we would establish contact with other civilizations and how basically it wasn't going to happen, how the Soviet has been withholding information regarding their development of the radio telescope and most experimentation they were doing in their search for extraterrestrial life was indeed classified. So the only source the U.S. actually had in regards to information about what they were doing was in their scientific publications. Now, I don't believe that for a minute.
Right.
You know? So again, it makes me question this whole report.
Yeah.
Because really, we have no inside intel.
Yeah.
On what the Soviets are doing with those radio telescopes.
Yeah.
You know, they're just sitting there and we're like, we don't know.
Yeah, everything is so compartmentalized that, you know, they're not going it's on a need-to-know basis, right?
Yeah, exactly. So other means of...
That's Agent Redacted. A ruckus over there.
So other means of possible communication are also discussed in this report, such as direct contact, that is interstellar travel, is directly discussed. Now, in the report, it specifically says it can be excluded from serious consideration because it's unlikely and it's appealing to the imagination. Appealing to the imagination. But the problem of travel, aggravated by tremendous distance, remains, and the various proposals of photon rockets take advantage of relativistic dilation of time will not be much use, even when they are technically possible. What does that even mean?
So does that mean they were developing that kind of thing?
It sounds to me like they're saying, even if we look at Einstein's relativity and we try and apply those theories to rocket propulsion, it's still impossible. So they can't see. They're saying, you know, on the one hand, they're saying this is pure imagination, but that's where science comes from.
Right.
Science is imagination. If you can't imagine these things, then they'll never be possible. So much has happened because people imagine it. Bias blows my mind.
Well, that's pretty common with a large number of people who look at this topic, scientists particularly. They say, well, we can't figure out how to do it, so therefore it's not possible. But if you think about science, it's really wild. Like you're saying, it's basically somebody imagines something and then they make it happen, basically, you know?
Yeah.
It's pretty wild stuff. We don't get to define the universe, but we figure out little ways to manipulate our environments and the universe and whatever, and we make these things that are pretty magical, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. So the bulk of the discussion, continuing from here, is that both in the Soviet Union and in the Western world, specifically in America, we need to collaborate. If we're going to get anywhere with the search for extraterrestrial life, there needs to be collaboration, which they say is really impossible at this point in time and therefore not doable.
Yeah.
Which, again, if we look at today and the scientific collaboration that exists worldwide, I think it's phenomenal.
Yeah. And part of the reason for that is just the amount of data there is to collect. You think, okay, we look up at the sky. Yeah. There's not that much stuff to collect. You could just point a camera up there. But the problem is what they're looking for is it like something like a narrow band radio signal. And you could have any number of radio signals that are narrow. Oh, my eye is killing me. Any number of narrow band radio signals. Like we have so many channels. I don't even know how many channels you can get. Just on like one frequency, there could be hundreds of channels, and you have to look at each little pinpoint in the sky, which could have thousands of data points every second.
That's why we really need the algorithms that exist now that are being developed, not just by scientists, but by their fellows and their residents and PhD students and master's students. They're developing these complicated algorithms and using these arrays to search for extraterrestrial life.
Right. Because we might have already detected an anomalous signal, but we just don't know it yet because we don't know how to filter for it.
Yeah.
And I've looked at some of these projects before, and some of their criteria are very restrictive. So restrictive, in fact, that I think they're probably filtering out interesting signals because they don't fit what they're looking for. But that doesn't mean it's not an anomalous signal. It just means that it doesn't meet their criteria.
They're looking for absolute proof positive,
right,
is what they're doing. They're like, there's so much information out there. This is what we need to focus on.
Yeah.
This is our focus. And they don't have enough resources to expand that search beyond those parameters.
That's resources is one of the problems. Yeah,
for sure.
But they've detected anomalous signals.
For sure.
But the signal didn't repeat. So they discard that. Instead, I think, why not look at that signal and say, okay, if we find a signal like this again, how can we get better data on this one signal, even if it doesn't repeat, you know? I don't know. But, I mean, I kind of want to do an episode looking through all the anomalous SETI signals I could find, because there's a decent number of them that are interesting enough to talk about.
Well, they also have limited funding. So in addition to people and energy and computer resources, there is an issue of funding.
Yeah.
So donate. Donate to SETI today.
Yeah, I guess so. SETI, I think SETI is private. It's not government funded.
No, I looked at the website. Remember we did a whole episode on SETI? You can donate.
Yeah, you can donate. But what I mean is it's not taxpayer dollars, though. It's all private funding.
Yes, but there's still a lack of funding.
Right. Yeah, the more money they have, the more they can do with it.
They can do, for sure.
Yeah.
So moving forward, I start cherry picking again. Just little tidbits I found interesting here and there. And because of the shift in, you know, the cultural differences between us and the United States and the Soviet Union, Soviets felt that if there was extraterrestrial life, specifically advanced civilizations, they would indeed be eager to impart their knowledge on us.
Hmm. Interesting.
So little different there. Not, you know, necessarily weaponize it or be hostile, but that they would want to share. I don't know how accurate that is. That's just what I found in the report.
I strongly disagree with that notion, because if they gave us their technology so we could travel the stars, an outside observer who saw our civilization would probably think, I don't know if I want to socialize with them. I mean, we are incredibly violent.
Yes.
Not just country to country, but even person to person. Every single day, there are people getting in fights, there are murders, there are crimes, there's a whole lot of shenanigans going on. We are not a peaceful people. We are very, very violent people. And I don't think that the aliens would give us technology, because I don't think we deserve it.
Yeah, Aiden Anderson almost got in a fight at the pharmacy.
Well, I wouldn't say that. Maybe I'll talk about that in the after hours, but...
No, it wasn't a fight. I'm just being silly.
No, yeah, we'll talk about it in the after hours, maybe. Who knows?
So moving forward, there's this conference I had talked about, and I cannot pronounce it because it's Russian, but I'm going to pretend I can. So I'm just going to be like, Burukan. I don't know if that's how you pronounce it. B-Y-U-R-E-K-A-N. And it was held at that observatory, so that's what it's named after, an astrophysics observatory in Armenia in 1964, and it brought together a large number of scientists in the Soviet Union to kind of pool their ideas, their resources, their knowledge about extraterrestrial life. And they discussed things like the radio telescope and how it could be used in their search. And there was actually a SETI research group in Moscow, although we have very limited information, but we do have a few names, and they mentioned those names specifically. And they give short autobiographies of those people. But they were really short and mostly scientific in nature. This conference was held in response to the 1961 Green Bank Conference, which is the observatory over here in the West. The goal of the Soviet Union conference was to arrive at rational, technical, and linguistic solutions to the problem of communication with an extraterrestrial civilization that is more advanced than Earth's civilization. Pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
Pretty straightforward. So the big name here is Kardashev. Kardashev.
Right, the Kardashev scale.
Thank you. And he was the leading mind of the time, and he thought within the next 5 to 10 years, all sources of radiation with the largest observable flux in all regions of the electromagnetic spectrum will have been discovered and studied. Mm. So he had big hopes for the future in terms of what the scientific community was going to do. And he thought after that point that the search for artificial signals would focus on objects of maximum luminosity. So he had this idea that something that was really bright or radiation belonging to a particular region of the spectrum and objects of significant mass were kind of going to be the focus of future endeavors. And he wasn't completely wrong. Mm-hmm. He wasn't completely wrong. Now, he did classify the different types of civilizations. You have type one, which is able to access all energy available on its planet and store it for consumption. So then they'd be able to control earthquakes, volcanoes, that sort of thing. Then we have type two civilizations that can directly consume a star's energy through something like a Dyson sphere, which we've talked about. And then type three would be a civilization able to capture energy emitted by its galaxy and every object in it, such as a black hole. Mm-hmm. So these are all super advanced civilizations because we're not capable of any of that. And he believed that SETI should concentrate on finding radio signals that could emanate from type two or type three civilizations, so the most powerful and advanced civilizations. Mm-hmm. And to provide evidence this might actually be an effective way, he looked at two radio signals discovered by the California Institute of Technology, and those were CTA 21 and CTA 102.
Okay.
Right? Have you heard of this?
Mm-mm.
Okay, great. So he found this radio source was notable because of its variability. So he said, because it's so variable, it's not regular, it must be artificial. That was his conclusion.
Interesting.
Right? So it's not regular. It doesn't make sense. We can't explain it. And that's true today. Huh. If you look at these two radio signals that are coming from these quasars, essentially, they are irregular and we don't have any explanation for them. If you look, this did hit the news. In 2016, CTA 102 was glowing at a magnitude of 17, and it had like this bright outburst invisible of light, and then it was about 250 times brighter than usual.
Wow.
Yeah, so this is all scaled, of course, to the luminosity of other stars, and I won't go into everything because I don't know everything, but the important part is that it was a lot brighter, right?
Yeah.
Okay, and then this was actually the most luminous, what they call blazar, this emission of energy from this quasar ever observed with an absolute magnitude of over negative 32. And I think I got this from space.com. And then a new outburst began in 2017 in December with an increased gamma and optical activity. And then it reached a different magnitude in 2017 of 14. So the whole point here is that it's not regular. And he argued, and it's been shown even recently, that because it's not regular, it's artificial. And I just found that fascinating. Now, mm-hmm. I'm not saying that's the correct conclusion, but that is a conclusion, and it's interesting.
Yeah.
It's an interesting conclusion, so.
I sort of disagree with the Kardashev scale a little bit, because if you look at the way our technology has gone, it's gotten smaller, not bigger. It's gotten more energy efficient, not less. So, for example, there's ideas that you might make an advanced propulsion work, like the Al-Kabiri drive, for example, if you were able to combine matter and antimatter, and you could get a lot of energy out of that, right? Just like when...
Yeah, no need to harness black holes.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. You're not going to... No advanced civilization is going to be harnessing their star's power or a black hole or the galaxy's power. They're going to come up with a power source that's so small and compact that you could use it wherever you'd like. Anybody who has the technology to build a Dyson sphere will have an energy source that will make such a thing completely obsolete. You know, like just think about cold fusion or something like that, or whatever the heck they can figure out to do on a quantum level, you know,
I don't know.
You know, they're going to figure out bigger or smaller, I should say, smaller and more efficient ways of generating power.
All right. And wow, I am like halfway done.
Only?
Well, a lot of it now is like quotes and appendices that I found interested that I will paraphrase on.
All right, let's do it.
But yeah, I loved looking into this and I might have gone a little overboard.
Well, it's a really, really cool topic and it's in the Blue Book files.
That's what was interesting about it. It's not a case file.
Yeah.
But it was top secret. It was classified. And, you know, we're looking at the Soviet Union. Just fascinating to me.
Right.
So in Appendix 2, it talks about the planetary requirements for life. You know, it talks about basically the habitable zone.
Mm-hmm.
But not, I don't think that had been really fleshed out yet. I don't think the language was used. Those ideas hadn't really been, they weren't understood like they are today. But then in a roundabout manner, they were talking about habitable zones. And basically, the conclusion, of course, was, it's very unlikely. It's unlikely there's any planets there. It can't be too big. It can't be too small. Gravity field has to be strong. It needs a hydro-rich atmosphere, yada, yada, yada. So that was in a whole appendix, and it was very contrary. It was very negative. Like, this isn't going to happen. Why are you even reading this report? All right. And then in Appendix 5, there were resolutions of the conference. So this is interesting because it looks like it was kind of a summary of the report with respect to the conference, and it's dated May 20th through the 23rd in 1964, mm-hmm. which I think probably are the dates of the conference. And it says, although the materialistic philosophy favors the existence of intelligent extraterrestrial life, at the present time there is no valid proof of life. However, there are strong indications that life might exist and might develop civilizations. A contact with extraterrestrial civilizations would be of the highest importance and interest, but until very recently, such a contact was clearly impossible. But of course, at this time, they're talking about, you know, with the new understanding of electromagnetic waves and the availability of the radio telescope, how that's actually changing over time and in the future. And so, so it goes on to discuss that. And it actually gives, there's a lot of mathematical formulas, and they're not all out to date. They're very simple algebraic expressions, nothing like calculus, kind of to describe the likelihood that we can communicate with life, that we can detect life, the amount of exoplanets that might exist, and those sorts of things. And they are antiquated. We're not going to use them anymore. But if you do study physics, if you do take astronomy, these are the same formulas that you will look at in a textbook.
Hmm.
So they appear in this file. Let's see. I'm just going to skip forward a bit because I have so much material. All right. And here in a different appendix towards the end, they start listing off the known scientists, as I said, with the brief autobiography, where they work, their publications, what they're known for, and there's like a whole list. There's like 20 of them. And the report ends with photos, I'm assuming secret photos, of known Soviet Union radio telescopes. And there were specifically two, RT-22 and Pulkovo. I think the Vs are pronounced Fs.
Hmm.
So Pulkovo. Could be wrong. So, in conclusion, so I've skipped ahead a bit.
All right.
Cherry picked and skipped ahead so that I can wrap this up. So, in conclusion, what this report basically sums up here is there's different points. I think there's 8 points, so I'll just run through them. The first point is that there is a high level of theoretical discussion going on in the Soviet Union, USSR, concerning the existence of extraterrestrial civilizations, but not much experimentation.
Hmm.
That's interesting. A lot of discussion back and forth, these conferences, but not much intelligence that we have about actual projects.
Right.
Anything besides talk. Theoretical means talk. So
they're talking about it, but they ain't doing it.
Mm-hmm. There is, point number two, a lot of influential astronomers, radio experts, physicists working in these discussions, like participating in these discussions. So there is an importance attached to this discussion in the USSR. If you have so many, you know, top-level people who are discussing it, there is considerable interest. But, point three, there is no evidence that practical steps on any large scale are being taken to contact or decipher messages from other civilizations, although there exist small projects of the size of OSMA in some institutions, notably the Sternberg Astronomical Institute in Moscow. I want to know more.
Yeah.
I would love to know more.
What's that all about?
Yeah, it's a small scale, but what are they doing? You know?
Hey, it's not the size of the project. It's how you use it.
So point four, they have a couple radio telescopes, so they must be doing some research. Point five, they talk about the conference and the necessity of a systematic survey, like a way to do a survey of the whole sky in order to locate artificial cosmic radiation sources. And point six, if such plans were going to be carried out, they really needed to be carried out globally. And I found it very interesting that this report is suggesting global cooperation at the height of the Cold War. And they mentioned possibly Chile, which I think, isn't there a radio telescope, like a big one in Chile?
Oh, I thought that was Argentina.
Is it? Okay. But you know what? You're right.
That's also the one that died. The Arecibo Observatory. It died quite spectacularly. Let me look up where that is. I thought that was Argentina. I'm not good with geography.
So it's interesting, though. They specifically mentioned Chile as a possibility where Soviet astronomers already have a foothold. Isn't that strange?
Yes.
Strange language. Point seven, international cooperation in such a large undertaking seems unavoidable. Accordingly, Soviet steps to establish cooperation may be anticipated at the next meeting of the International Astronomical Union in Prague in August of 1967. And finally, as in most Soviet scientific activities, there is noticeable emphasis on the practical benefits to be obtained from a systemic effort to contact other civilizations. The end.
Nice.
Bravo. Loved it.
That was a good story.
It was. It wasn't a case file, I know, but I had promised in the past to do it. So when I ran across it again, I was like, this is it. It's time. It's time to go over this.
Yeah, but it is in the Blue Book files, and it's really interesting. So why not? Also, we were both wrong. It's actually Arecibo is in Puerto Rico.
Oh dear. Oh God.
We way off. But I'm sure there are other radio telescopes in Chile and Argentina.
Yeah.
I don't know why I thought Argentina. Whatever. Because I'm a dummy. That's why.
Let's see. Radio telescope in Chile.
All right.
Yeah, there's ALMA.
Yeah, okay.
A worldwide collaboration.
Nice.
So that's interesting. So the report predicted the future. The future. The future. That's all I have. That is everything.
All right. I've got a couple more UFO sightings. I don't think I'm going to do all of them right now.
Well, we can save it for another Blue Book Day.
Yeah, or I can just do a quick little supplemental and then put it on the Patreon or whatever. But I'll do one more from January 11th.
Mine took forever, didn't it?
That's a good thing, though, because you were worried we wouldn't have enough to go a whole hour. And we could probably go two if we wanted to.
I might get sleepy.
Yeah, I'm already sleepy. All right, so January 11th, Cannon, New Mexico. This one had multiple witnesses who saw four oval-shaped objects that were the size of a school classroom.
Wow, that's quite descriptive.
Yeah, they were seen flying, three in a group and one separate that was moving up and down. The three were flying in formation. They were surrounded, the objects were surrounded by a luminous light blue haze. There was a power outage in the area at the time of the sighting, and the sighting lasted 20 to 30 seconds. It happened at nighttime, the local time 23:15 or 11:15 at night. a quote from the cover of the document, the cover card: no supporting aircraft movements in this area at the specified time. So in other words, the Air Force couldn't find an airplane that was theirs or that was a civilian airplane. There were no aircraft in the area. And also the cover card has in brackets, it says, sketchy report. Okay, we've got three witnesses, but somehow it's a sketchy report. Get out of here. Remember, like I said, this is when they were in full debunking mode. They were not investigating stuff right. anymore at this time. They were just trying to make stuff go away. And the evaluation of the case was insufficient data for evaluation, which is fair enough, I suppose. I don't know. So the three witnesses were a housewife and two teachers, which explains why they would describe it as the size of a classroom.
Yes.
Because the questionnaire says, what size would it be compared to an object that you're familiar with or something like that? And they're familiar with classrooms, they're teachers. Even though the report has lots of good data provided by the witnesses, and there are lots of pages there are that were filled out, the questionnaires and stuff, by all three witnesses, and there's data like weather conditions and viewing angles and all that good stuff, there's a page in the report that's a letter that's to the attention of Major Orion T. Clark, and here's a quote: reference your SWSS-2 15001 January 67 subject UFO. Your report concerning a UFO incident of 11 January 1967, inadequate and incomplete. Request you comply with paragraph 7 and 9 of AFR 80-17. Signed, James C. Manat, Colonel, USAF Director of Technology and Subsystems. So if the report is quote unquote incomplete, you don't even have to look at it. You say, this report's incomplete, I'm just going to kick it right back to you. And it's going to end up, you know, in nowhere. It's going to end up nowhere. They're never going to investigate it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So I thought that was interesting that even though there's plenty of good data to go on here, they just, you know, this officer just decided, get it out of my face. I don't like it. All right, on the questionnaire, question number 7, any unusual activity or condition, meteorological, astronomical, or otherwise that might account for the sighting? And the witness said none. So they don't consider that it could be due to a natural event of some kind or other.
Right.
Question 7J, it says that there was no air traffic or released balloons in the area. So that's interesting. They're straight up saying it's not a weather balloon. That's a first. 7K.
Not a balloon.
Yeah, not a balloon. Item 7K, the position, title, and comments of the preparing officer, including his preliminary analysis of the possible cause of the sightings. And then he handwrote just, quote, no supporting aircraft movements in this area at the specified time. So the preparing officer is supposed to give his preliminary analysis of the possible cause, and he just says there were no aircraft movements in the area. He's, I don't know, dude. He's like, I'm not touching this one with a 10-foot pole. So I don't remember really hearing about AFR 80-17 before, so I went ahead and Googled it, and it's available on QFON.org. And it's actually an update of a previous document that I have talked about. It. Maybe I'll go over it in a bonus episode at some point. I don't know. But that's actually kind of a short sighting. That's pretty much all I have on that one. But it's a good little sighting. You have multiple witnesses that saw something weird. What more do you want out of a sighting, right?
The size of a classroom. We want aliens.
Yeah.
We want all the little green men.
Yeah, they didn't see aliens in this case, but they did see an anomalous object. The next one I have, I'll do it in a bonus episode, is from Charleston, South Carolina. It's a radar visual sighting.
Oh, wow.
Those are the cream of the crop right there. But I think I'm going to wait, do those on a bonus episode, because I'm starting to have trouble talking here, as you can probably tell. So I think we will wrap this one up for now. All right. Well, any final thoughts, Agent Ether?
Well, I had a lot of fun. Next time, I'll probably pick some case files. Those are my favorites, I have to admit. But I really enjoyed reading about this scary times we live in, but
yeah,
brought me back to the good old days. I did grow up in the 80s. I'm a Gen Xer, so I do remember the times. And yeah, I was kind of nostalgic. I don't know if that's the right word. I've been thinking a lot lately about how I grew up in the 80s and how we're middle-aged now. It's very sad.
It's weird. It's definitely weird.
It's very weird. But no, thanks for presenting those cases. I always enjoy hearing about people's sightings.
Yeah, and they are, there's always good sightings. I think I have two more to talk about, and I think one of them is a sighting by an 8-year-old.
Love it. You told me about that earlier. You did.
Fun sighting. So I think I'll talk about those in a bonus episode or something.
Maybe we can do one together and I can look up some case files.
Yeah, that'd be great, actually.
Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah, that'd be really fun. I love this stuff. Honestly, I could do a show just talking about Blue Book files.
Forever and ever.
No kidding. But I think that maybe people would not, you know, I think that might be too much of a good thing for some people anyways. I don't know. But all right, well, I guess that's all we've got for you guys this time. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, you could really help us out by giving a good review wherever you listen for the audio version. And if you're watching us on YouTube or on a video format,
thank you.
Yeah, you could really help us out by giving us like the thumbs up and leaving a comment and all that kind of stuff. All that interaction really helps with the algorithms, and it really helps further the show. And you know, the bigger the show gets, the better it gets. So we really appreciate your help doing that.
So then Agent Anderson can go to small little places like California and look at microfiche.
Yeah, so I have a budget to fly to California and dig through their old library microfiche. Why not, you know?
You would too.
I would definitely do that. Absolutely, yes.
All right, guys.
All right, so until next time.
Keep it strange.